The History of the World podcast, written and presented by Chris Hasler.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
Welcome to the History of the World podcast magazine. Hello everyone, and a very warm welcome to the History of the World podcast magazine. This week, I thought I would try something just a little bit different. And so, the subject for this week's episode is history from A to Z. So, we're going to start with the A's in the immortal words of Kid Creole. Let's start with the A's. So this week is all about the letter A. Now, don't worry, this is the History of the World podcast. You haven't accidentally tuned into Sesame Street. This is the History of the World podcast. But this week we're going to concentrate on historical figures beginning with the letter A. And we start this journey by looking back at Aristotle. Aristotle was an ancient Greek philosopher and polymath who lived from 384 BCE to 322 BCE. He was a student of Plato and later became a teacher of Alexander the Great. His works cover a wide range of subjects, including metaphysics, natural philosophy, logic, ethics, politics, and the arts. Aristotle's intellectual legacy is vast, and his methodologies and analytical frameworks laid the groundwork for various disciplines that are still studied today. So now let's look back in the archives of the History of the World podcast to a time when we talked about Aristotle. Plato was around the age of 30 at the time of Socrates' death, and rather than be a figure of controversy within Athenian society like Socrates, Plato decided to set up a school of philosophy so that the Socratic ways of thinking were being developed in an institutionalised environment, and hopefully therefore not upsetting too many people by asserting opinions onto others. Plato's school would be called the Academia, and was founded in 387 BCE. The Academia became an admired institution that would be preserved after Plato's lifetime. Plato and his students would philosophize about all aspects of humanity, including human emotions and the nature of human behavior, continuing the enlightened discussions of Socrates. It is from Plato's name that we get the word Platonic, as in Platonic love, which is a form of love alternative to romantic and something that was typical of the emotions being discussed and debated within the Academia. One of the more famous students under Plato's guidance at the Academia was a man called Aristotle. Aristotle would found his own philosophical educational establishment at a place called the Lycaon. And this venue would ultimately be a place that Aristotle would transform into an educational establishment for all subjects, whether it be economics, theatre, poetry, logic, biology, or even politics. Aristotle himself would write a number of academic books across a range of subjects, all taught at the Lyceum. Still prominent was the subject of philosophy, and distinct branches of philosophy were emerging as the rhetoric, debates and theories became deeper and more diverse. Debates on whether life should be lived in search of the enrichment and fulfilment of the individual mind, as opposed to the more dutiful existence as a contributor to society alongside your fellow men and accepting your position. This kind of deep thinking would develop and to a degree still be politically and ethically debated around the world to this very day. Some say that this is the birthplace of Western philosophy, but I do believe that this is a very lazy analysis, and at the risk of sounding like Socrates, is a bit of an urban myth. Those who know a good deal about the history of education will know that during medieval times, the Islamic world would be a dominant front runner in academia, and it would be ignorant to say that this wasn't influenced by those Greek societies. However, Greek academia surely has to have been a product of Asiatic ideas that were clearly around in places like Babylonia centuries before. When you look at the wonderfully and highly complex design of the pyramids of Egypt, to my mind, it is impossible to be ignorant of there being a higher level of academic thought and understanding in those ancient societies who were around hundreds and hundreds of years before the Greeks. If I'm wrong about that, then yes, it was probably aliens. The classical thought of philosophy, attributed to the times of Socrates, Plato and Aristotle, represent a great milestone in the journey of academia and represent one of our earliest understandings of the history of philosophy as an academic study. At the conclusion of last week's episode about the Battle of Leuctra, we left a little teaser about a young prince from the Greek-speaking lands of Macedon, who was being held captive in Thebes, but also where he would be receiving a valuable education. The young prince's name was Philip, and this was in the 360s BCE, when the Academia was firmly established. Philip went back to Macedon, where he would become the king in 359 BCE. But he would be aware of his great contemporary, Aristotle, and in 342 BCE, before the age of Aristotle's work at the Lycaon, Philip would send for Aristotle to visit Macedon in order for him to be a tutor for his 13-year-old son, Alexander. That is a story for another episode. Now, of course, we discussed or we touched upon Alexander the Great, who also begins with the letter A. And he is also known as Alexander the Third of Macedon. And he was born on July the 20th or 21st, 356 BCE, and died on June the 10th or 11th, 323 BCE. So interestingly, he died before Aristotle. He was the king of the ancient Greek kingdom of Macedon from 336 BCE until his death. Tutored by Aristotle until the age of 16, Alexander succeeded his father Philip II to the throne at the age of 20. His achievements have made him a lasting symbol of successful leadership and conquest. We don't know too much about Alexander's infancy, and this is mainly due to the fact that there were no known Macedonian historians from this period. So when Alexander eventually became the king, he would commission his own biographer, not only to document his achievements, but to make his young life sound fantastic, including stories of him being the only person able to tame a wild Thessalian horse. As we have already discovered, Philip was definitely investing in Alexander, likely preparing him to be his successor. He would want to provide him with the same standards of education that he had personally enjoyed, and so he sent for Aristotle, the student of Plato, who was on the island of Lesbos. Alexander was about 13, so this would have been a critical time in his life, when he would have been getting prepared to become a man, and all that being the precious son of a king would entail. At some point during his childhood, we can suppose that Alexander was first exposed to the works of Homer, such as the Iliad and the Odyssey, the works which may have been around 500 years old at the time, and would have told stories of old Greek peoples living alongside the Olympian gods. These stories would inspire Alexander throughout his entire life. By the age of 16, Alexander was being propelled into a position of importance. While Philip was campaigning, Alexander would be the regent of the realm. This would turn out to not just be a nominal title, but something that Alexander would need to actually do in his father's absence. When a Thracian tribe challenged Macedon, Alexander put the rebellion down and established a city in their territory. This seems to be a very able thing for a 16-year-old regent to do. So it does appear that Alexander had the potential to be a strong leader from a young age. There was no reason for Philip to not take Alexander on campaign with him to really bring him up to speed as a military leader and somebody who could confidently lead Macedonia should anything happen to Philip himself. The priority for Philip in 338 BCE, when Alexander was around the age of 18, was to settle down the polis of the southern Balkan Peninsula, particularly Thebes and Athens, as they were revolting against Macedonian hegemony. Differing opinions about Alexander's exact role at the resulting Battle of Chaeronea exist, but what we do know is that he was there, and what we do know is that the Macedonians scored a decisive victory over the Thebans and the Athenians. Alexander, as a commander, must have played a key role in the battle. This was the point in history where we can recognise Macedonian subjugation of all Greek lands of the Balkan Peninsula, save Sparta, who typically stayed out of affairs and posed no issue to the Macedonians. This new Greek alliance is referred to as the Hellenic League. Philip, by this time, was in his mid-40s and was warming up for his big life ambition, which was to invade the Persians. In the same way that many Greek exiles had headed into Persia over the years, we know that Persian exiles had also headed into Macedonia and undoubtedly shared what they knew about Persia with the Macedonian royal court, including Alexander himself. The death of Philip. Last week we told the story of the death of Philip II, so we won't go into it in too much depth this week. We did tell of how it was a former homosexual lover of Philip named Pausanias who assassinated Philip at his daughter's wedding. Although it was convenient to state that Pausanias, the jilted lover of Philip, decided to take his own revenge on Philip in the worst possible way, there is more to this story than meets the eye. Philip's wife and the mother of Alexander, Olympias, commissioned a memorial to Pausanias, who was reportedly chased down and slain directly after killing Philip. Why she would do such a thing is mysterious, but it does raise suspicions about whether Olympias had something to do with the death of her husband. We are aware that Philip had another son by another of his wives, and his name was Carinus. Carinus was reportedly murdered at the command of either Olympias or Alexander. So would the plan have been all along to get rid of Philip and ensure Alexander's ascension? Alexander was very quickly proclaimed as the new king of Macedon, and some of those Greek poleis that had been obliged to become a part of the Hellenic League now saw an opportunity to revolt against the Macedonians, now that the mighty and wise Philip was no longer around. The Thebans may have wished that they had been dealing with Philip instead of his son. Alexander's reaction to the revolts may tell us all we need to know about the nature of Alexander. Initially, Alexander attempted to deal with the Thebans by diplomatic means, but as soon as he realised that the Thebans were only interested in opposing the Macedonians, Alexander took an army of over 30,000 men to Thebes, where not only did he achieve a victory at the Battle of Thebes, but he would also destroy the city, sending a clear message out to the other Greek poleis that a similar fate may await any of their rebellions against the Hellenic League hegemon, Alexander. It is very much worth mentioning at this point that Alexander desired to pick up the ambition of his father Philip and march into the lands of Achaemenid Persia. The reasons for this appear to be to liberate the Ionian cities of western Anatolia, who were culturally and linguistically Greek in origin. The Ionian city-states had been torn between the Greeks and the Persians for the last 200 years. Alexander wanted to instigate democratic rule to stand in the face of the Persian tyrannical rule, and he would also want to make the Persians pay for their destruction of the Acropolis of Athens during the Persian invasions of Greece, as told during episode 12. Now remember, these are only snippets of old episodes, so you can listen to the entire episode about Alexander the Great if you want. You don't have to stop there, so just go back in the archives, back into volume 3, find the episode on Alexander the Great, and you can listen to the rest of the story. Now, moving on, our next A is Archimedes of Syracuse, who was a highly esteemed ancient Greek mathematician, physicist, engineer, astronomer, and inventor, born around 287 BCE and passing away in 212 BCE. He is celebrated for his substantial contributions to the fields of mathematics and science, particularly for his pioneering work in the principles of physics and his innovative mechanical inventions. His legacy has endured through the ages, influencing countless generations of mathematicians, scientists, and engineers. If we look even further west and across the Mediterranean, then we should not forget the island of Sicily and the fact that Syracuse on the east coast was founded by the Corinthians and has remained closely linked to Greek politics. During the 4th century BCE, in the time of Alexander the Great, the Greeks of Syracuse were in conflict with the Carthaginians in the west, and this is something that we looked at back in Volume 2 when we discussed the Punic cultures during Episode 9 on the Phoenicians. During the 3rd century BCE, the island was invaded by King Pyrrhus of Epirus, a character who we have stumbled across before due to his invasion of Sicily and the Italian peninsula, and the fact that before this he had briefly co-ruled Macedonia alongside Lysimachus. Pyrrhus bit off more than he could chew, as we detailed in that same episode back in Volume 2, and had to leave the island of Sicily for good. This would allow Syracuse to blossom during the middle of the 3rd century BCE, but over in the west of the island, the ever-growing Roman Republic was pushing the Carthaginians out, and ultimately into an unlikely alliance with the Syracusans as the Romans turned their attention to conquering Syracuse as well. Syracuse turned to one of their own for ideas on how to combat the Romans, and that Syracusan man's name was Archimedes. Archimedes was a mathematician of highly advanced intelligence, mastering the mysteries of mathematical theories and their application to engineering. However, if we go back again to Volume 2 during Episode 7 regarding the Assyrian Empire, we discussed how the Archimedes screw method of pumping water may have existed a few centuries before Archimedes' own lifetime, and that there is evidence of such a pump existing during the Assyrian Empire that may have even irrigated the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. However, we shouldn't take anything away from Archimedes. His expertise is responsible for the incredible claw of Archimedes, which has to be one of the most impressive and innovative ancient weapons. We don't have any contemporary detailed descriptions of the claw of Archimedes, but the general consensus is that it was a great feat of engineering that wasn't unlike a type of crane. It towered over the city walls where it would hook itself onto a warship, lifting one end out of the water before releasing it suddenly, where it would either capsize or cause chaos for surrounding vessels. Despite Archimedes' expertise and the noted success of these claws, the Roman Republic would ultimately defeat the Syracusans after a long siege of their city. Sicily was now under Roman rule, and despite calls for Archimedes' own life to be spared, he was killed in the aftermath of the siege, much to the dismay of the Roman general Marcus Claudius Marcellus, who wanted to enjoy the benefit of Archimedes' supreme mental abilities. Roundup. So let's attempt to track the events that followed the story of the Diadochi, which was the subject of last week's episode. One of the characters of last week's episode was King Pyrrhus of Epirus, and he was well known for his invasion of the Italian peninsula and the island of Sicily. Now, we know that the polymath Archimedes was born in Sicily not long after Pyrrhus invaded, but it seems that Archimedes had gone to study in Alexandria before Pyrrhus invaded. As we know, Pyrrhus scored famous victories against the Romans, but he lost all of his best officers in the process and ended up worse off than if he hadn't invaded, which has led to the creation of the phrase Pyrrhic victory, which describes a victory that might as well have been a defeat. Just because the last of the Diadochi died in 281 BCE when Seleucus Nicator was murdered by Ptolemy Corvinus, this didn't prevent there being ongoing tensions between the Hellenistic kingdoms. The most well-known conflicts were between the Seleucid Empire and Ptolemaic Egypt over the lands of the modern-day country of Syria, and these are known to history as the Syrian Wars, and both sides were determined to be in control of these lands, neither one being at all prepared to accept defeat for any length of time. However, the 3rd century BCE was also a time of greatness, with the success of the Museum of Alexandria, with its great library, which is where Archimedes went to study, and the construction of the Lighthouse of Alexandria. We also saw that the Colossus of Rhodes was built at a similar time. Pergamon's stature improved from being a rump state of the Lysimachid Empire into a Pergamon Empire in its own right. A new Greco-Bactrian kingdom broke away from the Seleucid Empire in the east. A is also for Augustus, born Gaius Octavius and also known as Octavian. He was the founder of the Roman Empire and its first emperor, reigning from 27 BCE until his death in 141. That's not right. No, that can't be right. Not 141. What have I written there? Until AD 14. That sounds a bit more like it. He was born on September the 23rd, 63 BCE in Rome, Italy, and died on August the 19th in 14, in the year 14 CE. And he died in Nola in Italy. He was buried in the mausoleum of Augustus in Rome, and his reign set the tone for the emperors who followed.
Egypt had been successfully annexed, and the Ptolemaic kingdom was over. Egypt was now just a province of the Roman Republic, and there was now nobody of any great note who could challenge Octavian, either on a military or a political level. He was the most powerful statesman of Rome. Julius Caesar had managed to get himself in a similar position around 15 years earlier, and Caesar made himself a dictator for life. But this was not enough to prevent the Senate from rising up against him. On reflection, the Romans may have regretted challenging Caesar, as it had done more harm than good by plunging Rome into a series of conflicts that would have had their foreign enemies rubbing their hands together. So, would the Romans challenge Octavian in the same way that they had done to Caesar? Octavian decided that he wanted to lay down his powers in 27 BCE. However, the Senate decided that he be named Princeps of Rome, which is the first man of the state, similar to a president or a prime minister. As Princeps, he would hold consular powers. He didn't really need to be declared as a dictator, as the army was either loyal to him anyway, or they were Mark Antony's old legions who had been absorbed into Octavian's army after Mark Antony had fled to Africa. This meant that Octavian had the ability to dispatch forces to different areas of the Republic, so he was effectively doing most of the jobs that a dictator would be doing anyway. His personal name was changed to Augustus, meaning illustrious one. Over the coming years, Augustus was granted further powers. He had already been granted authority over Egypt, Gaul, Germania, Hispania, and Syria, and in 23 BCE, he was also granted authority over all other provinces, where he was declared Imperium Maius. He was also declared as a tribune to the plebs, which allowed him to represent the citizens of Rome. All of these honours and accolades amount to one certainty. That was that Augustus himself was now more powerful than the Roman Senate, and the Roman Senate now answered to him because of the political powers that he now possessed. This would also mean that Augustus himself would be in a position to hand-pick the men who he wanted around him, and the men who he would ultimately want to succeed him. One man who he had great confidence in was Marcus Vipsanius Agrippa. Agrippa had been loyal to Augustus throughout his conflicts with Antony and Cleopatra as a military commander, and after this time he was an integral part of the renovation of the city of Rome, turning it into a comfortable place to live for all classes of citizen, building aqueducts and baths and enhancing the public services within the city itself. Privileges previously exclusive to the wealthiest classes of Romans were now being extended to the population in general. Rome was becoming a very modern city. Agrippa himself would marry Augustus's daughter, Julia, and would be granted the position of tribune to the plebs. It appeared that Agrippa was being groomed to become the successor to Augustus, but it is also important to state that Agrippa was a similar age to Augustus, so there was no guarantee that this would happen. During the year 12 BCE, Agrippa was on a campaign in Pannonia, which was an area of Rome's empire that was to the north of Illyria, and in turn the Balkan Peninsula. While there, Agrippa would contract an illness which would take his life. So Agrippa would not be the man to succeed Augustus, but Agrippa had contributed a lot to the administration and improvement of the empire.
A is also for Attila the Hun, also simply known as Attila. And he was the ruler of the Huns from 434 until his death in March 453. He is often remembered as one of the most feared enemies of both the Western and Eastern Roman empires during his reign. Attila led a vast empire that included Huns, Ostrogoths, Alans, and Bulgars, among others, in Central and Eastern Europe. The name Attila itself is thought to derive from East Germanic origin, meaning little father. Around the year 430, two brothers were at the forefront of Hunnic politics as their leaders. Their names were Oktar and Rugila. They had managed to unite the Huns to some degree under their leadership, and unity would become something of a formidable presence in Europe. In 430, according to the Christian historian called Socrates of Constantinople, Oktar burst from excessive consumption one night and died, leaving his army to be routed by the Burgundians. This left his brother Rugila in sole charge. There were many Hunnic soldiers who had fled from Hunnic service in order to exploit the riches and opportunities of serving under the Romans. Rugila wasn't particularly happy about this, and he demanded of the Eastern Roman Emperor Theodosius II that those Hunnic mercenaries be sent back to Rugila and the Hunnic Empire. Some of these Hunnic mercenaries had even fought against their own during the Hunnic raids on the lands of the Balkans during the 420s. The Romans did have a level of respect for the Huns, and they were even paying them a tribute as a preventative from further invasions, and this may have been agreed in the aftermath of the Balkan raids. Rugila was putting pressure on the Romans and was on campaign against them in 433 when he was killed. So now the two brothers Oktar and Rugila were dead, and the Huns had lost their leaders. Oktar and Rugila had another brother called Munjuk, and he himself was a Hunnic chieftain. Munjuk would have two sons, and their names were Bleda and Attila, and it would be these two brothers who would become the new rulers of the Hunnic people. Attila is the Attila that has become the most famous of all Huns in history. With regards to his childhood and upbringing, we really don't have much to go by. We can assume that he would have been vigorously trained to be a Hunnic warrior from a very young age, learning horsemanship and archery to a very high level. As we already know, the relationship between the Eastern and Western Romans during the 5th century was fragmented. For example, when Ioannes was the emperor in the West, it was opposed by the Eastern emperor Theodosius II, who worked hard to instate Valentinian III in his place. The politics of the two halves of the Roman Empire could be different and at times in conflict with each other. So when tensions were high between Hunnic tribes and Constantinople ruled by Theodosius II, Valentinian III was happily utilising Hunnic mercenaries in his battles against the Burgundians. So it is impossible to paraphrase the relationship between the Romans and the Huns at any point, because both entities were not operating as a united nation, and with each leadership change could be a political shift that would change the balance. So it is better to look at the relationship between the leaders of the respective tribes and nations.
By the reign of Valentinian III, the young Roman who had spent some of his childhood in the Hunnic royal court called Itius was now back in Western Rome and serving under Valentinian III as his main military general. It was Itius who campaigned against the Burgundians alongside Hunnic mercenaries. In the meantime, Bleda and Attila were putting pressure on Emperor Theodosius II in the east by threatening military action if he didn't meet Hunnic demands, including inflated tribute payments. The Huns really had the Romans in a difficult position, and a statesman of Eastern Rome signed the Treaty of Margus in 439, which agreed to the Hunnic demands to return all mercenary Huns, as Bleda and Attila's uncle Rugila had requested during his lifetime. It also gave a Roman agreement to double the tribute payments to the Huns. There was an advantage to the Romans to this agreement if we look at the bigger picture though, because with the Huns on their side, it would mean that they could utilise them to protect their northern borders, because if the Huns were happy with the agreement, they wouldn't want any Germans or Persians jeopardising it. This would mean that Rome could send more troops to Sicily and North Africa to defend their realm against the aggressions of the Vandals. However, Bleda and Attila would claim that the Romans had not returned the Hunnic fugitives and therefore was in breach of the agreement. So the Treaty of Margus had already hit the rocks within a year of its signing. In 441, Bleda and Attila had mobilised their army and breached the Danube border, therefore invading Roman territory. This was an absolute disaster for both Eastern and Western Rome because the Huns had become so militarily powerful that the Romans couldn't resist their advances, and many cities were destroyed from Illyricum in the west to the outskirts of Constantinople in the east. Both the Eastern Emperor Theodosius II and the Western Emperor Valentinian III had no choice but to sue for peace with Bleda and Attila of the Huns, as there was now a direct threat to Constantinople itself. The Hunnic demands of the Romans was now around three times the amount of the original tribute during the reign of Rugila. So the relationship between the Huns and the Romans had reached unprecedented levels of intensity. In the year 445, Bleda died. The cause of his death is ambiguous. There are historians who claim that it was simply death during campaign, but others believe that it was at the hands of his brother Attila, and that if it was, then it may have been because he learned that Bleda was plotting against him. It's almost impossible to know the real truth.
Our final A is Alfred the Great, whose full name was Alfred or Elfrid, and he was the king of the West Saxons from 871 to 886, and he was the king of the Anglo-Saxons from 886 until his death on October 26th, 899. He was born between 847 and 849 in Wantage, Berkshire, which was part of the Kingdom of Wessex. Alfred was the youngest son of King Ethelwulf and his first wife, Osberg. His legacy includes his role as a defender of England against the Danes and as a promoter of learning and literacy. Alfred was born in the year 849 in the village of Wanating, which is the modern English town of Wantage. When he was born, his father was the King of Wessex, ruling as King Athelwulf. Alfred had four older brothers. The eldest one was named the King of Kent, which had been brought under the control of Wessex. Alfred also had an older sister who was married to the King of Mercia while Alfred was still an infant, so Athelwulf was working hard to keep Wessex as the most powerful kingdom of Anglo-Saxon England. Alfred was sent to Rome as a child, where the Pope Leo IV invested him ceremonially as a consul. He may have been accompanied by his father, the king, who we know to have travelled to Rome at a similar time, but in his absence, Aethelwulf's son and Alfred's older brother, Aethelbald, took control of the Wessex throne, and when Aethelwulf returned, he couldn't successfully regain his kingdom. Aethelbald died in 860 and was succeeded by his younger brother, Aethelberht. Throughout all of these reigns, the kingdom of Wessex was repeatedly attacked by the Danish Vikings. Aethelberht was succeeded by his younger brother, Aethelred, in 865, which was a very important year in the history of Great Britain. It was in this year that the Danes arrived with their biggest army that had ever graced British soil, referred to as the Great Heathen Army. This Danish army were prepared for more than just a raid. The Danes wintered in East Anglia, giving the king there very little choice about it. After the Danes marched on York the following year, King Aethelred of Wessex and his younger brother Alfred, now around 17 years of age, knew that they could no longer ignore the threat. Aethelred and Alfred joined King Burghrid of Mercia, who, if you remember, was married to their older sister, and together they besieged the city of Nottingham, which was occupied by the Danes, but they could not sustain the siege. Nonetheless, the Danes decided to go back to York. They then conquered East Anglia and reportedly killed and blood-eagled the King Edmund, who refused to denounce Christianity. Edmund's death has caused him to be celebrated as a Christian martyr. The Viking act of blood-eagling is believed to be a gruesome ritual where the lungs were extracted from the back of the victim's broken ribcage like a pair of wings. With Northumbria and East Anglia conquered and Mercia now subject to the Danes, the next target would be Wessex. Alfred spent most of his days either preparing for battle or actually in battle with the Danes, with mixed results, with some battles going in favour of the Danes and other in favour of Wessex. When King Aethelred died in 871, it was not sensible for the throne to pass down to his infant son while Wessex was at war, and so Alfred was crowned the new king, something that he may never have expected, being the fifth son of his father. The Danes continued to attack, even while Alfred was attending his older brother's funeral. The pressure created by the Vikings was too much, and Alfred paid the Danes to stay away. And so they did. Thank you very much indeed for listening to this week's History of the World podcast magazine, our first in our series of History A to Z. Hope you enjoyed that one. Hope you enjoyed something a little bit different. Now, if you enjoy listening to the podcast and you want to support the podcast, then please do visit our website, historyoftheworldpodcast.com. Click on the Patreon link and sign up to make a monthly contribution. By doing so, you'll become a lifelong member of the History of the World podcast Illuminati, and you'll qualify for gifts and rewards. Go to the website and have a look at what you can win. This week, we welcome into the History of the World podcast Illuminati, Matthew Moss and Westall. So thank you so much to you both for your support. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, I'd love that. Drop me a line at historyoftheworldpodcast@mail.com. You can also follow the podcast on social media. We're on Facebook, X, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, Tumblr, Threads, and Mastodon. And if you can't get enough of the podcast, then look out for our special debrief episodes, where I'll be talking some more about some of the main episodes and a little bit of extra bits and bobs.
Listener messages and reviews.
Jose Antonio Sarmiento Garzon has written in and said, "Hi, I just started a week ago. I have loved the podcast. It's just what I'm looking for in this world of opinions. Yours is an informed opinion, so thanks for that. And the way that you present is really interesting. I'm a psychologist. If you can put some input in behaviour, what would be good? Thank you for this." That's from Colombia. Yes, I think if we're looking at human behaviour, I think a lot of historians now really try and psychoanalyse why people have done certain things. And probably one of the most interesting psychological analyses that I've seen of an individual, and I mentioned this in my reply to you, Jose, was that of King Henry VIII, the Tudor King of England, who was quite an athletic and handsome and attractive young man in his youth, and turned out to be this overweight tyrant with a fierce temper and an intolerance in his older years, a selfish intolerance. And historians have speculated for many years about how this change come about, and we wonder, you know, could it have been down to mental illness? Could it have been down to, he fell from his horse at some point during his life, and it seemed to be, that seemed to be a pivotal point in terms of when he changed from being this fresh, young athletic man to this sort of fat and cantankerous old man. And a lot of historians have speculated about that. So it's fascinating to psychoanalyze historical figures and try and reason with why they did what they did. So very interesting indeed, and something we haven't spoken much about really in the history of the podcast. So thank you, Jose, and very good email. Justin Newbury has emailed in, said, "Chris, I hope this email finds you well, and with it I send warm regards. My name is Justin Newbury and I'm from the southeast of the United States, originally Georgia, but I've lived in Florida most of my life. I'm ashamed to say I've been listening to the History of the World podcast for years now, since you were plodding through classical antiquity, but haven't made time to write in, even though I've been telling myself I would forever. I'm a truck driver and my schedule is very, very busy. Not that that's much of an excuse when I think about all you've been getting done. Don't I know about it? I just wanted to introduce myself. It seemed the least I could do after all this time, especially since I feel almost as though I know you after listening to you for so long. I listen to many educational podcasts while I drive." Very good, Justin. "I've found it's a way to keep growing while I spend countless hours on the road in an effort to salvage some of the time I lose to my career choice. Hopefully it will keep my grey matter sharp instead of letting it turn to gelatin. There are many good ones out there, but I must say that yours is one of the best. Thank you." Thank you, Justin. He's got on to say, "A lot of my other favourites are more specific on a subject matter, or they do mini-series about an event or a period, or just tell you about the events of a certain day, etc. I've not come across anything else with such a wide, sweeping, all-inclusive scope, and it's wonderful you've decided to take this route. I would like to thank you for your hard work and dedication. I'm truly amazed at what you've accomplished over the last several years. It's a labour of love, really, and I feel you deserve a great deal of heartfelt praise for the hours of in-depth research you put in and the attention to detail with which you orchestrate your presentation. It's wonderful the way it ties some of the other information I've come across from more specific, subject-specific sources, giving me a true bird's eye view. Besides actual content, though, I think it's really refreshing that you are so unassuming in your delivery. You're clearly very intelligent, but you are also polite, which says a lot about you. And I'm sure I'm not the only one who appreciates that. Your care in dealing with areas of possible contention or uncertainty is very thoughtful and creates a welcoming environment for anyone who isn't super closed-minded. And I find that very admirable also. You just seem like a genuinely nice guy and you have a good sense of humour. There are not necessarily common traits among people when who take a great interest in history. Well, okay. Ooh, many are quite the opposite, really. I think that's not necessarily my experience, Justin, but I understand where you're coming from. I feel your approach and demeanour makes all of the information much easier to absorb and definitely much more enjoyable. I know I've gotten very long-winded here, which I do, but I just felt it was far past time to say hello. I've benefited so much from your efforts. The least I could do is give you a well-deserved pat on the back. I think you're doing a hell of a job and I hope you keep up the good work. Until next time, Justin. Justin, a very, very well-written, eloquent and complimentary email. I really appreciate the time that you've put into that. It's very, very kind. And as ever, I often say it's quite humbling to receive such praise. And I'm glad I come across well. I think I've always wanted to come across well. I've always wanted mainly to come across as quite unassuming. I think that's probably one of the key goals for me, is just to make sure that I'm presenting the information in a very neutral fashion. I think once I was taught, and maybe by a historian, that the best way to present work, it might have been by a broadcaster actually, but the best way to present work is not to do the thinking for your listener. And by that I mean that the listener will feel rewarded if they have made their own conclusions or drawn their own conclusions rather than be told what to think. And I think that's more rewarding for the listener, is if they have an ability to anticipate what you're going to say before you say it, by reaching the same conclusion or drawing the same conclusion as you, before you've even mentioned what you feel the conclusion is. So if that makes sense, sorry, that was probably a bit of a long-winded way to respond, but hopefully you know what I mean. And I've always endeavoured to be that way. I think that's a much more rewarding experience for the listener, is not to be told what to think. But that's a very, very good email, Justin. Really, really do appreciate it, and thank you for sticking with the podcast. Moving on, just one review this week from Germany. So that's great. There's often, I feel, my listener demographic is very much centred on USA, UK, Australia and Canada. And apart from that, it's a very low percentage from elsewhere. So I'm always thrilled to get feedback from other countries. So 48CDY from Germany has put, excellent podcast, love the podcast, at volume 2 now, will definitely be recommending to my friends. Thank you. Anyway, that's it for this episode. Moving forward, our next episode is going to be a good one. It's The Travels of Marco Polo, not the book, but my own version of the story. So that will be coming up in the next couple of days. So just bear with me a little bit while I make the final preparations of that episode. And then there'll be a debrief episode, of course, accompanying that with some latest news with the History of the World podcast. Of course, I've just realised this month I'm going to the podcast show in London. So if any of you are there, hit me up and I'll let you know what day I'm down there and what I'll be doing. Hopefully we'll hook up for a coffee if you're interested. So do let me know. Anyway, that's it for this episode. Thanks for listening. Be sure to look out for The Travels of Marco Polo. And until then, until next time, be good.
The History of the World podcast, written and presented by Chris Hasler. Please consider making a financial contribution by going to the historyoftheworldpodcast.com website and clicking on the Patreon link. Email the show at historyoftheworldpodcast@mail.com. And don't forget to join our social media at Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. See you next time.